All right, it is time for us to get started this afternoon. We are in the last part of Daniel chapter 11 as we're working our way through this book, and we'll be wrapping it up in the next week or so. My goal is to get through this chapter today, obviously, chapter 12 next time, and then I'd thought about, I never know what a congregation is interested in as opposed to, you know, a class I teach at the college in a more academic setting. But one of the things that we've kind of hinted at from time to time as we've worked through the text is the debate about the historicity of Daniel, whether it's a historic, it's telling us what actually happened and when it was written, and kind of a skeptical view on that. And I thought about doing a class that deals with those sorts of issues from a more conservative believing sort of perspective, to kind of acquaint you with some of those ideas and why it's not a crazy thing to have a position of faith that we have. So I thought about that. So if we do that, that'll be 2 weeks out. And if you just absolutely do not want to ever do anything like that, let me know. And if you just think that's a fantastic idea, let me know. And if you don't say anything to me, I'm going to presume you don't care enough to say one thing or the other, in which case I'll just do what I want to do. So yeah, kind of think about that over the next week or so, and let me know what your feedback is on that kind of class, historicity and the date of the writing of Daniel. I just sold that really well, didn't I? That sounds just so exciting. Historicity and the date. Ooh, boy. It is more interesting than that might sound. But let me know what you think about that, and we'll come to that in a couple of weeks. Let's begin today with a prayer. Our good Father, we're thankful to you that, as we have seen so many times over the course of this book, that you are in control. And that as bad times come, we know that even those are in your plan. And as your people suffer, we know that even that is not outside of your control. And that you are working even those things out to your good purposes, where you will be glorified and your people will be delivered and reign with you. So help us to grow as we study, to be strengthened in our faith, and to learn more and more to trust in you rather than the things that we see in this world all around us. And it's in your Son's name that we pray, and amen. All right, so we're going to start kind of like we did last week. Last week, if you were here, actually, whether or not you were here, this is what we did last week. But if you remember what we did last week, what we started with was kind of a very brief synopsis of the history of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and then looked at how that is played out in the text of Daniel 11. There's some of that that we need to do again today, but it's a lot less time. This chapter is just slowed down and slowed down and slowed down as we've gone through it. It starts with, you know, basically all of Persia in a verse, and then Alexander in a half of a breath, it seems. And then, even when you get to the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and you're talking about more details, it's still moving very rapidly. And then when we get here to this last king that will be discussed, Antiochus the Fourth, it really slows down, and you get a lot of detail about this one individual, because he is going to play such a prominent role in the history of the Jewish people in particular. And so this is God letting them know in advance that he knows what is coming and that he is in control of what is coming. And when things get as bad as they're going to get, that's not outside of his control or his plans. And so I think it'll be helpful again to kind of run through the history very quickly, then see how it lines up with the text. And then that will get us to the last few verses of this chapter, which, anyone who tells me that they're 100% sure they know exactly what it means, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in that person. This is one of those sections of text that has just been debated and debated and debated and debated. And even, I mean, obviously there's your unbelieving biblical scholar and your believing biblical scholar debate. There's your premillennialist and your amillennialist debate. But even outside of those, you find a bunch of people that are all believers and all kind of coming from that same theological framework, and they're still going to disagree about what this is about or just find themselves scratching their heads saying, I'm just not sure. So I'll tell you at the outset today that in 40 minutes or so, I will be scratching my head saying, I'm not sure. I'll do my best with what it says. I'll present to you a variety of approaches to it and what I think are strengths and weaknesses of them, And I'll leave it with you to meditate about the end of this chapter, because it's just one of those spots that you find in the Bible where you say, you know, I'm not sure what to do with this beyond some basic principles. And that's okay, because we don't have to understand everything about God in order to have faith in God. So let's start, though, with a brief synopsis of the history here. We are talking about Antiochus the Fourth, or he is called sometimes Antiochus Epiphanes. It's a nickname that he gave himself. It means something like manifestation of God. So real gem of a fellow, you can tell. Anyone that gives himself a nickname, probably there's a problem there to begin with. But when it's a nickname like God manifest. I'll probably go back and forth in calling him one of those two things. I'll try to stick to one or the other, but I can't guarantee it. But the same person, Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, he comes to the throne by intrigue rather than by birthright. He was fourth in the line after Antiochus the Third. You might remember last time we said Antiochus the Fourth was a political hostage in Rome while his father was on the throne. It was a way of keeping Antiochus the Third in line and doing what he was supposed to do. But when he dies, and his son comes to the throne. They realize that the brother of the king isn't as good of a political hostage. So they take this other king, I think it's Seleucus IV is who we're up to at this point. They take his son as a political hostage instead and send Antiochus IV back. The prime minister of the Seleucids assassinates the king and tries to take the throne for himself. Antiochus IV musters an army and goes up against him and takes the throne back. There is an infant who would be in line ahead of him as well, and he presumably kills that child and leaves the rightful heir in political prison and takes the throne himself. He will have a lot of dealings with the people in Judea. He will depose the high priest, because he was bribed by the high priest's brother, because he wanted to be high priest instead. So Antiochus the Fourth kicks out Onias the Third and puts Jason in instead. A little while later, a family, the Tobiads is the family, that they're also vying for power. They bribe him with even more money, and one of their family members, Menelaus, is made high priest instead of Jason. So basically, the high priesthood of Judea was up to the highest bidder as long as Antiochus the Fourth was around. Whoever gave him the most money, he'd kick the last guy out and make this guy the high priest instead. He went on a couple of military campaigns against Egypt, against the Ptolemies, trying to, again, expand the border. Same thing that we saw last week, the back and forth between them, except now the Seleucids are really the ones that seem to have more power. The first time he goes down, he conquers much of the region. He overthrows one of the Ptolemy kings, but leaves him on the throne basically as a puppet king. You know I'm in charge of you, basically, is the idea. He'll campaign against Egypt again later on, because some stuff happens in the intervening years and we don't need to get in all the details of that. But this time, the Ptolemies receive assistance from the Roman fleet under a fellow named Papilius Lenus. And he comes with an order for Antiochus to read and presents them the order to read, and he looks at it and reads it. And basically what it says is, you withdraw from Egypt or you will be at war with Rome. That's the upshot of it. And he looks at it and he reads it and says, I need to go consult with my people and we'll get back to you. And Lenus draws a line, a circle around Antiochus and says, decide before you step out of the circle or you're at war with Rome. And there is nothing that Antiochus can do at this point except say, yes, sir, take his army back north. And it is a absolute humiliation for Antiochus. And it's shortly after this, not only because of this, but I'm sure this doesn't help at all, that he really begins raging against Judah. Part of it has to do with rumors of Antiochus' death in Egypt, where Jason being the first high priest to bribe and kick out the last guy, he got ousted. There were rumors of it that Antiochus had died, and so Jason tries to retake the high priesthood, which Antiochus views as a revolt, and since he's in a foul mood from being humiliated as well. All of this is ultimately going to lead him to outlawing the practice of Jewish religion. And if you practice the Jewish religion, you will be killed, is what it all boils down to at this point under Antiochus IV. He orders that scriptures are burned. He orders that Sabbaths and all other festivals are not to be observed. He orders that the Jewish food laws are to be abolished. He orders that circumcision is forbidden. He puts an idol of Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem and sacrifices on the altar of the temple to Jerusalem. And that sacrifice was a pig. Now, you want to think of the perfect storm of ways to insult the Jewish people. It's putting an idol and an idol's altar on the temple grounds and offering a sacrifice to that idol, and that sacrifice being an unclean animal. You can't make Jews more angry than that did. And then you add to that everything else, scriptures being burned and Sabbaths being forbidden and circumcision being outlawed and all of those things that go with it. Antiochus is trying to promote a single cultural identity. He's trying to push Hellenism, Greek way of life and thinking, to unify the kingdom. And so if you're not a Hellenistic thinker, if you're not a Greek way of thinking, you've got problems with him. So in 169, he plunders the temple. In 168, he outlaws Judaism. In 167, he sacrifices that pig on the altar. And all of this is what then is going to consolidate itself all down into the Maccabean Revolt. And we won't get into all of that. That's fascinating history, but that gets us past the text of Daniel that we're talking about. And so we'll stop there as far as this little history goes. But except to say that pig was sacrificed on the altar in 167, the Maccabees were done by 164 in rededicating the temple. So in just 3 years, you know, give or take, depending on the months, they have wrested control from Antiochus of this region. And it's about the only truly independent state the Jews had was during the Maccabeans period. And the Maccabees ended up being just as bad or worse than the Seleucids were by the end of it. But then Antiochus dies in 163. There's very little known about how he dies. The sources are split. Some say he died while raiding a temple. I think that's what David found. David's not here, is he? I think that's what David found last week, is that the story about him raiding a temple in Persia and dying there. Others say that he was poisoned or had a sudden disease overtook him. So we don't know exactly how he died, except it was the year after that. Sean, were you going to say something?
Can I ask, the Jews had a temple at that time?
Yeah, they did. The Temple of Zerubbabel had been rebuilt by that period.
So did Epiphanes go into the Holy of Holies and actually sacrifice the pig?
I don't know where exactly he did it. I don't know even know if the records... Does Maccabees talk about that?
Well,
out front, yeah, that's why my first thought was it was kind of the main altar out front was where it happened, but I don't. He may have walked in there too.
Did you actually commit sacrilege in the Holy of Holies? That's another step.
Oh, he absolutely would have dared to do that. I don't know if he did.
That's three layers in.
Yeah.
Holy of Holies.
Yep. So yeah, I don't know what exactly he did. Some of that is detailed in First Maccabees. It talks about some of that. And I've not looked at it recently enough and close enough to know or to recall all the details of what he did or if it's even said. But I have no doubt in my mind that Antiochus would have done that. If, you know, nothing would have stopped him in his own mind from doing that, at least. So, all right, well, that's kind of our brief historical backdrop. Again, what we'll do is kind of work our way through the text and see how that plays itself out in the text. Because at various levels, that's all showing up here. Some of it more than other things. Some of it is just part of the story that you need to connect one dot to the next. So it's not all going to be here in great detail. So verses 21 through 35, then, of Daniel chapter 11. In his place, that is the king of verse 20, shall arise a contemptible person. Now we're to Antiochus IV. A contemptible person to whom royal majesty had not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers had done scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time, and he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him, his army shall be swept away, many shall fall down slain. As for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil, they shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white, until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. All right. So, as we move into this section, 21 through 35, I think is pretty clearly about Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes. And as I said about really all of chapter 11 up to this point, there's really no debate among anyone who studies these texts, except for maybe a few of the details people will quibble about. But the big picture, everyone agrees, this is the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and now we're on to Antiochus the Fourth. And so a few of the specifics working through this, not enough to do a whole other handout, so we'll just put this all on a slide. Verse 21 is Seleucus IV being replaced by Antiochus IV, who, as we said, was not heir to the throne. Seleucus's son Demetrius was the heir to the throne, but he's the one that is in Roman prison, I believe, or he's the one that Antiochus kills, one or the other of them. Both of them were in line for the throne ahead of Antiochus. So the contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given, that's Antiochus the Fourth. There is debate about, a little bit of debate at least, about the armies being swept away before him, even the Prince of the Covenant. People will say this is either Onias the Third, the high priest, who you could very easily call the Prince of the Covenant, who is being swept away in this context. He's being deposed and replaced by someone else. Others say, no, this might refer instead to the covenant that the Seleucids and the Ptolemies had at this point, kind of a standing of peace, and he is breaking that covenant. And Ptolemy as a king, you could call him the Prince of the Covenant of that relationship. And it's about that, that first Egyptian campaign, something along those lines. Either one of those, and nothing hangs in the balance on this, so it's not that big of a deal to stop and really flesh it out much more than that, but it's probably one of those two things. Some have suggested that verse 23, making reference to him becoming strong with a small people, may refer to the fact that there were some sympathizing, Hellenizing Jews, even in this day. This is going to become an ongoing problem that is present even in Jesus' day, not exactly the same sort of thing, but you think of the Sadducees. This is the priestly sect in Jesus' day, and they were about as secular as it came. They were sympathizing with the Romans. They were more about political power than they were about the law or anything along those lines. And so it's a little bit different, but the idea, I mean, we might think from our perspective, if we're not aware of the history, we might think, there's no way any Jews would ever go along with this, right? Just read the first half of the Old Testament. We'll see that no Jews ever go along with anything that's against the law. It's pretty obvious that that's not going to be the case. But there were some who went along even with the Hellenizing influences of Antiochus, and this may be a reference to that. Verses 25 through 28 is the first Egyptian campaign. Verses 29 through 35 is the second Egyptian campaign. Again, some of the details are a little bit clearer than others of the details, but it's obvious when you're reading this text and you know the history of Antiochus that this is a poetic apocalyptic description of those campaigns. And so he's going against the king of the south in verse 25, and then it goes really well in these verses. And then in verse 29, he again goes to the south, but this time it will not be as it was before. And so those are those two Egyptian campaigns. The first time it went well, the second time it doesn't go well. The ships of Kittim are the Roman fleet, is what that's a reference to. What on earth is Kittim, you ask? It's a city on the island of Cyprus. You say, wait a second, Cyprus isn't Rome? This is one of those things that over time it comes to mean something different than what it actually literally means. So, the way this kind of evolved over time, this word and its usage, it's a city on the island of Cyprus, and eventually it came to refer to all of Cyprus. If something came from Kittim, that means it came from Cyprus. But then it evolved further, where anything coming from Kittim came from the west. From where you are on the Jewish side. So, and I don't know if it's because that was like a major port and it was the last stop and everyone always stopped there, or if it's just kind of, it came from, on the other side of the Mississippi or something along those lines, where, the river means more than just the river. Ultimately, Kittim comes to refer to the west. And so ships from Kittim means a western fleet is all that means. And again, pretty clearly, that's the Roman Empire is what that's a reference to. In fact, the Septuagint translates this with as the Romans, a Greek word for that. But instead of saying ships of Kittim, the Septuagint just says the Romans came. He was afraid and withdrew. That's, of course, Linus forcing Antiochus' withdrawal. And what does he do? But he turns back in his wrath and takes it out on the covenant, of course, is then reference to God's people that he's taking his wrath out on. Verse 31 is the violation of the temple. Profane the temple and the fortress and take away the regular burnt offering. Remember, everything Jewish is being outlawed during the time of Antiochus. That's what's being talked about there. Verse 32, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall take... who shall stand firm and take action. And this is one spot where there is some more significant debate as to who those people who know their God are. One of two groups are just about invariably pointed to. You probably immediately think of the Maccabees because I just got done talking about them. That's one of the groups that this might be. Well, taking action certainly fits them, but the Maccabees... their motivations were as political as they were religious. That's if they were equal parts political and religious, they were as political or religious as they were political. It may have been they were more political than religious. However, there's another group of Jews who come to be called the Hasidim, the Holy Ones. And this is a group that opposed Antiochus for very religious reasons. And so a lot of people say this is the group that's being talked about here. These are the people who love God. I think we have an Amber Alert. Oh, there's one up here too, isn't there? Maybe Antiochus is coming to get us. So, where was I? Yeah, so this group of people that are very dedicated to the law and to worship and to keeping holy things holy, they're really the religious driving force of the rebellion. The Maccabees become the political and military element of that makes it happen. But this group is more of the religious side. But, again, I don't know that we need to get too hung up on that as far as you know, debating, or if we don't know this, you know, we don't know anything or anything along those lines.
Context, though, aren't the Hasidim precursors to the Pharisees?
Yes. This, and I think you can even go back beyond this. You might say that this is the outgrowth of people like Ezra, even, and his dedication to the law. And the Hasidim kind of come from that, and that all ultimately becomes the Pharisaical kind of mindset of devotion to the law. And obviously we don't want to get too far down that path, but just by way of reminder, we hear the word Pharisee, we're like, oh, those are the bad guys. Because, you know, that's how we've read our Bibles our whole lives. But if you're a first century Jew, you wouldn't have thought, oh, Pharisee, that's a bad guy. You would have thought, oh, Pharisee, that's a holy person. That's someone who really cares about God and his law.
But they actually started out good.
Yeah, yeah. And they did start out good, but even their perception in the time of Jesus is that they were good.
By that part, they're actually bad. We know that.
Yeah, we know that. And, yeah. But Jesus conflicts with them to us. It's, well, of course Jesus is conflicting with them. They're a bunch of hypocrites. But that's not how that whole thing would have been seen on the ground in the first century.
Well, of course, it's always complicated. Because Jesus, even on occasion, he'd say, you know, you're not far from the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah. So, yeah, do what they do. Just, you know. Yeah, so there were certainly good things about them even then, but there were some seriously flawed things about them even then, too. So verse 34 then might be a reference to the Maccabees. And so one way of reading this, the people who know their God being these very, very holy people standing firm and taking action, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. That kind of sounds like the politically motivated Maccabees maybe joining with them and taking advantage of this opportunity to get Antiochus out of things. And then, of course, there's a lot of bad things happening through all of this. Some will be stumbling, which I don't think is a moral stumbling necessarily, but the idea of being persecuted, people being killed is a part of this, very clearly is part of this as well. But again, this is just a really quick snapshot in advance of what is going to be coming during the time of Antiochus. And I think, as I said already, the point of all of this is so that when it happens, the Jews can look at this and say, God knew this was coming. And as bad as it might be, what we see here is that God is, in fact, in control of what's going on in the world. All right, like I said, I don't want to get too hung up on this. I want to spend some time here on this part of the text that is a bit more baffling. But I'll stop for a second. Questions or comments about this historical prophecy? Andrew.
I don't know if he was doing it with other nations in the area, but why would he take particular exception, Antiochus, that is, to the Jewish people? Is it because he couldn't Hellenize them?
There's probably a variety of things that are going on with his motivations. One thing, it may be as simple as, you know, you hear the story, which, you know, you hope is apocryphal, about the you know, the guy that hits his thumb with a hammer and turns and kicks the cat. Why does he kick the cat? Because it's there. That's why. Take out his anger on something. And the first thing that's closest to it is the target of the anger. So some of it may be as simple as he's retreating from Egypt and is humiliated, and who's first in line. So that may be a part of it. But we do know that Jason tried to take the high priesthood back because he heard that Antiochus had died, and Antiochus saw that as rebellion. So that might have been kind of a catalyst. And then the fact that he's trying to Hellenize them and a group of them are resisting, that's only going to add fuel to the fire. So I don't know that we could necessarily say here's one thing that is the reason why they were the target more than anyone else, but it's probably a variety of different things all kind of coming together.
Well, to that too, there's a lot of Jews that want to be Greeks.
Yes.
And they're pushing Antiochus. You know, these ignorant hicks, they don't know what's good for them. We got to drag them kicking and screaming into the, you know, 2nd century B.C.
It's the 2nd century, guys. Catch up with the world. Yeah.
Of
course, they weren't counting that way.
Don't be on the wrong side of
history. they should have known that. Counting down the way they were, they should have known that Jesus was going to be around in just 200 more years. They were just off by a few years, though. The calendar didn't line up quite right. All right, well, let's turn to this last section, and we'll read on into chapter 12 today. We won't spend as much time on that part of the text, but that is where this vision is going to come to an end. So I'll read this, and then we'll talk about what the basic problem that we face in this text is, and then maybe I'll give you a second. Maybe you can solve it and we can quit early. But if you can't, then I'll tell you what other people have said over the years. So, chapter 11, verse 36. And the king, presumably Antiochus IV, but remember throughout this chapter, sometimes kings come and go without any indication that it has changed. So, presumably Antiochus IV, but possibly someone different. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. Still sounds kind of like Antiochus. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many and shall divide the land for a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and of silver, and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in its train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. And he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been seen since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. All right. Maybe before I tell you what I think problems are with this in terms of interpreting it strictly as more of Antiochus, anything jump out at you as why maybe we're not talking about Antiochus anymore? Okay. Yeah, so we've got what is universally agreed to be the clearest verse, Old Testament verse about the resurrection. And when is all of this happening, you know? Verse 2 of chapter 12, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And this is happening, verse 1, at that time. What time? Well, the time of when all of this is going on. And so, I don't know, if the resurrection happened when Antiochus IV was around, we all kind of missed it by a couple thousand years. There was no general resurrection during the time of Antiochus. So there's kind of your first clue that maybe something has changed. A couple things here. The allegation by the skeptics of the Bible is that the prophecy, as accurate as it was up to this point, is suddenly very inaccurate. And that's our basic problem, because the things that are talked about here don't happen during the time of Antiochus IV. For example, it talks about him campaigning against Egypt again, and there was no third campaign against Egypt by Antiochus. He campaigned against them twice, but not a third time. And so that seems to be problematic. The way that it describes his death is not how he dies, pitching his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain. So somewhere there along in the strip of Palestine seems to be the idea, but that's not where Antiochus IV dies at all. No matter, there's debate over how he dies, but that doesn't match any of the accounts. So either they're all wrong or this isn't talking about that. And then, of course, the resurrection doesn't happen right after Antiochus IV dies. So those are kind of the, you know, big sorts of issues with this. As we move through this text and say, well, what's being talked about now? So, like I said, I've got a variety of views that people have posed over the years that I thought I'd share them with you so you can see different ways that people have tried to think through this. I don't know about you, I always think that's helpful to think of how other people have thought through a text. But before I do that, any thoughts from any of you about this? Yeah, Ethan? Okay.
And is there, what are the pros and cons of him being talked about maybe in this sort of section?
Well, we certainly have the idea of spiritual forces that are at work throughout this section of Daniel. I mean, this entire vision, remember, 10 through 12 is all part of the same vision here, and that's where we run into the prince of the kingdom of Persia and the angel that the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstands, and reference the prince of the kingdom of Greece, and Michael, who is your prince, and then here we've got Michael, who is the great prince. So the idea that there are spiritual forces behind the nations is certainly at play here. It would be the one thing that I would say that would make me hesitate on that is that everywhere in Daniel where they're talked about, they're called princes. And so it's not impossible that suddenly the king could be this figure instead of the prince. But that'd be a bit of an abrupt change. That's an interesting thought. I mean, certainly the fact that this is something that is at play in all of this. And ultimately, the spiritual realities behind all of this is what matters in the grander scheme of things. Sean?
What do you think verse 37 is really pointing out and saying about this figure? Because it's almost like it's implying how inhuman he acts. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, what really stands out to me is he'll have no desire for women. That's just the way it reads in mind. Like, that's
okay.
Just a normal thing. You know,
yeah.
Or he will have no regard for the gods of his fathers. Or show, he will magnify himself above all. It's almost like he doesn't act human.
Yeah, it's kind of the most extreme form of narcissism or something along those lines. I think that's right. The verse 37 is just highlighting how he cares about nothing other than himself. And again, that fits Antiochus very well, but it fits a lot of other people that are like Antiochus too. All right, let me run through some approaches that have been posed to this. We'll start with our friendly, liberal, critical, unbelieving biblical scholars. You know, those people who spend their whole life studying the Bible even though they don't believe it. They always have lots of insight, right? Well, sometimes they can say some really helpful things, but they also kind of get themselves derailed in a variety of ways. Well, what this view says is, aha, failed prophecy. This tells us exactly when this book was written, because everything up to this point was history posing as prophecy. And we've gotten to the present day, and the author doesn't know what's going to happen next. And he says, I'll give it a shot. I'll try some real prophecy myself. And it never comes true. And that's what's going on here. Now, on the upside of that view, we have to stretch here. But on the upside of that view is it gives this way of thinking about the book of Daniel kind of a unified view of the entire book from beginning to end. The problem is, I mean, as a group of people who believe, well, you see what the problem with it is, just on that fundamental level. We are, you know, we're in a different worldview than that. It just is not something that, that meshes with what we believe about the text. Beyond that, well, if we do that other class, we'll come back and talk about this some. The book of Daniel was accepted as scripture in the mid-second century. And if this was a forgery, fake prophecy that was written half a generation earlier, there's no way it would have been accepted widely as scripture at that point. It's just a very difficult thing to buy into, aside from just the grand worldview difference. We talked about dispensational premillennialism in an earlier class. This is the view that says there's going to be a great Antichrist who's coming, a great tribulation. Great parenthesis, you remember that? The period of time where prophecy has stopped. The church age that we're in right now, none of the Old Testament prophecies are about right now, this view says. The prophetic clock has stopped and it's going to start back up when Jesus returns. And all of the Old Testament prophecies are about the millennial kingdom that is going to be coming. But this view, so basically this view says between verses 35 and 36 is the great parenthesis. So verse 35 is Antiochus, verses 36 and following is still in the future. And it looks like it hasn't been fulfilled because it hasn't happened yet. This is all Antichrist stuff. And this explains the failed prophecy because it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't failed. But I think magically creating thousands of years between two verses is pretty bad interpretation. And I think dispensational premillennialism in principle is bad theology. Remember, this is the view that says Jesus failed and that's why the church got started. And maybe next time when Jesus comes back, it'll work. Now, again, that's not how they would characterize it, but that's the upshot of it. Jesus was supposed to establish his kingdom the first time and didn't, and he's going to establish it the next time. So I have a hard time buying into anything that is premillennial. Some see this as a final antichrist that is not in the whole dispensational framework. There are people that believe there is going to be an end-time antichrist that are not tied up in a premillennial kingdom or in a millennial kingdom in some way, although some of them still are, but they're just not dispensationalists, and we don't need to get into all of that. But basically what this view says is it does change from Antiochus to the antichrist in what is called telescoping prophecy. And what telescoping prophecy, that term comes from the idea that when you look off into the distance, there you see all sorts of things that look like they're at the same basic level, but as you get closer and closer, you can tell how far apart some of those things are. And it looks like it's all talking about the same thing, but it's really not. And you just have to get closer to be able to see it. And so that's kind of where that terminology comes from. But that's what this is, supposedly. It looks like it's all talking about the same time period, but it's not. And as we get closer and closer, we'll be able to see that a little bit more clearly. In this view, the resurrection is the final resurrection, of course, as it is in dispensationalism as well. But this does still kind of leave us with inserting a gap into the text in some way or other, perhaps. And we'll talk more about the resurrection itself. I think there's some interesting questions that have to do with that. Some say that this is Rome. It's the Rome view. That when you get to verse 36, we're no longer talking about about Antiochus. Now we're talking about the Roman Empire. So it is a new king. It's a different king. And again, as we've said, that kind of happens in Daniel chapter 11 sometimes. You got to switch from one king to another without any sort of warning at all. This avoids the problem of the unfulfilled prophecy. It helps find some fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy in the New Testament and the church. However, there are some elements of this that just don't work very well. It seems a bit contrived in some senses, but again, the idea of telescoping prophecy isn't itself a bad idea. That multiple things can be talked about at the same time that may, you know, at a distance look like they're all in the same place, but as you get closer and closer, you begin to see how far apart they are. So there may be some merit to some of that. And some see this as just kind of a summary of Antiochus. Rather than a third Egyptian campaign, rather than more in the future, It's still Antiochus. We're just summarizing his entire life. And there's no difficulty in applying verses 36 to 39 to Antiochus. It's verses 40 through 45 where it gets a little bit harder to pin that down. In this view, the resurrection is not the final resurrection that's being talked about. It's something different. Typically, it's seen as a spiritual awakening, that kind of moral resurrection. And part of the reason why that is said is notice in verse 2 of chapter 12, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Well, I thought of the resurrection, everyone did. And again, we'll talk about that more next time, but that's part of what this view will hang its hat on. It's not the final resurrection, it's a spiritual resurrection for many of the Jews. And again, this is an attempt to solve the problem of the unfulfilled prophecy, keep things in the context of the Seleucid kingdom, which everything else in this chapter is about. I don't know that spiritual awakening is the best understanding of people who are in the dust of the ground getting up. So I don't know that that's the best view either. One other thing about that is also that usually when there's kind of a summation statement in a Hebrew narrative, it's at the beginning of it, not at the end. In the Old Testament, if you've never noticed before, keep an eye out for it, but very often a chapter or a story will begin with a summary statement before then giving you all the details of the story. This is a little bit backwards for the summary to be at the end rather than the beginning. And then finally, some people think that this is just a retelling of the second Egyptian campaign, emphasizing maybe the political side of it rather than the resulting religious persecution. So kind of going back and filling in some of those gaps that got left off when he turned his focus to the persecution that happened to the Jews. And again, solves the inaccuracy of the prophecy without resorting to gaps or anti-supernatural worldviews. Various elements of 29 to 35 and 40 to 45 can kind of be parallel to one another. If his death isn't necessarily connected to the promised land, though, then you've got an inaccuracy problem there. And there's nothing else. There's no other point in all of Daniel, and particularly in Daniel 11, where the author stops in the middle of a prophecy and goes back and retells part of it from a different perspective. So that'd be a very different thing going on. So those are just about every view I've come across. And I don't think any of them are overwhelmingly satisfying. There are things about some of them that I like, and there are things about all of them that I'm not as keen on. I would say that I'm about out of time, and maybe I should just quit and dodge this entirely. I would say that I think it's helpful to realize how much chapters 8 and chapters 10 through 12 have in common. They're the only two visions that mention any kingdom, particularly their Persia and Greece. They're the only two visions that make no mention of the coming kingdom of God or the Messiah. They're the only two visions that speak specifically about the time of the end and the period of indignation. They both have instructions to seal up the vision. They both use the expression the beautiful land. They both speak of the suspension of the daily burnt offering. They both have angels appearing in connection with a river. Both of them speak of the first king of Greece being broken. Both of them have a significantly higher level of historical detail than any other vision in the book. So there's a lot of reasons to read 8 and 10 through 12 in conjunction with one another. They're clearly of the same cloth, so to speak. And we should probably try to interpret 10 through 12 as being parallel to 8 as much as we possibly can. But then also, and I'll quit with this for today. I'll ask if there's any comments afterwards. But yeah, like I said, I'll scratch my head and say I'm not entirely sure what to do with this text. I've repeatedly emphasized as we've gone through the book of Daniel that the visions themselves have a degree of ambiguity in interpretation more so than we typically think. We name names and we name kingdoms, and the visions typically don't. And that leaves the level of ambiguity so that people in just about any era who read them and see things from the vision applying in their lives can say, this is true of me right now too. Even if it's not necessarily true in all the detail, I see how this applies to me even now. And many generations can see various levels of fulfillment in their own time and appreciate those applications. It guards against thinking that the world is better now than it was back then. In some senses, obviously it is and it was, but I don't know that morally it is. And all of those kinds of things. And so, This is the single section of the book of Daniel that I have the least confidence in my interpretation of about anything in the book of Daniel. And I'll just admit that I find myself scratching my head and being unsure. Just like I said 50 minutes ago, I would say. 45 minutes ago. All right, so I'm done talking. Any last comments about this before we pretend like this class never happened and move on next week? Tom?
Well, I would say it's commendable if you say you don't know it, you don't know it.
Because but you know?
There's an awful lot of pressure out there. I'm not claiming to know.
Oh, okay, rats.
There's an awful lot of pressure out there that, you know, the preacher has to take a view on every single thing, and he's got to be dogmatic about it, or that's not strong preaching and wishy-washy or something. And the reality is, you know, you keep studying the Bible your whole life, and you're never going to get, you know, a fraction of it.
Yeah.
And it's not just Daniel. It'll happen in other places as well, like Matthew 24. I'm pretty certain Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But at some point in there, it seems to segue to more ambiguous kind of statements of destruction and judgment, which very well could be the end of time, the final judgment, or, you know, something in between. But, you know, it's like you take the destruction of Jerusalem as an example, but it's applicable to any future judgment that you might want to bring. But it's not helpful to say, oh, it's this or it's
right.
This or it's this.
Yeah, and I wish this was ambiguous enough to just do that and say, well, you know, it's moved on to ambiguity now, and it can apply to any, and it's just a little too specific for that, for my taste, although I do think that idea is true even here. All right, like I said, I'm done with Daniel 11 for a very long time. So we'll talk about Daniel 12 next week.